Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12, and you'll also receive a complimentary 6 months of digital access to The Telegraph for free.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Fraser Nelson, I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So the Prime Minister has spent today in front of the liaison committee being grilled on everything from Brexit to COVID. James, what did we learn?
So I think the most dramatic exchange, perhaps, was when Boris Johnson was asked by Hilary Benn, who chairs the kind of EU exit committee, whether he thought the EU was negotiating in good faith or not. Now, this matters because one of the arguments for the provisions in the internal market bill is, look, the UK is only doing this because the EU aren't negotiating good faith. Boris Johnson took a long time, but eventually he basically said, no, I don't think they are. Then Hilary Benn said, well, why did the Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis say that the EU were negotiating in good faith this morning? At which point Boris Johnson was like, well, of course it's possible, but I'm mistaken. And I think what this speaks to is a kind of broader confusion in government about what the arguments for the Northern Ireland clauses in the bill are. We've had tonight the dramatic resignation of Lord Keane, the Advocate General for Scotland, because yesterday he implied that Brandon Lewis, he told the House of Lords Select Committee that Brandon Lewis was wrong to say that this was illegal, that this was a specific and limited breach of international law and advanced kind of different argument. Brandon Lewis this morning then told a select committee in the House of Commons that Lord Keane had now told him that he thought Brandon Lewis was right. This basically put Lord Keane in an impossible position and he has now resigned. And I think what these incidents relate is the extent to which the government is kind of on the hop from this row. And if this was not enough drama, and I promise I will shut up at some point, we've also had a joint statement tonight from Damian Green and Bob Neil saying that they've reached a compromise with the government and the government will table its own amendment to put a parliamentary, so that there has to be a parliamentary vote before these powers in the bill.
So Damien Green and Bob Neil were two of those who rebelled against the government a couple of nights ago.
They had put down together an amendment requiring a parliamentary vote before these powers are used. So you have all of this drama, which has been caused by the Northern Ireland clauses in this bill. This bill was meant to, I think, heap the pressure on the EU. I think what it's actually done is test the government's own unity.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how we have seen that the government in the past day or so try and actually use the internal market bill to attack Labour. So yesterday you had an email going out to Conservative members, supporters, those on Conservative mailing lists, saying, you know, Labour and the SNP have voted to frustrate Brexit, not help, you know, the government defend the UK. The government will always defend the UK.
But the idea was anybody who didn't support the internal market bill was somehow trying to frustrate Brexit.
Exactly.
Right? And by the way, where would Sajid Javid fall in that camp?
Yes. And even Geoffrey Cox. You know, Sajid Javid didn't vote for Brexit, but I think he has shown it. But
it's
Geoffrey...
It gets desperate stuff, isn't it?
Even harder when you have committed Brexiteers saying they have a problem with it. So I think you can begin to see how they initially thought this is going to be something that they could use to politically attack, stop talking about coronavirus, start talking about something they're quite comfortable with, Brexit, rally the troops, unite the base. But as James touches on, it just hasn't worked out like that. And I think the fact that they have come up with this compromise, also the fact, something I put in my iColumn today, that Oliver Lewis, when he addressed on Monday night the One Nation group, said, and he's one of the senior Brexit advisors in the building in number 10, he said that he was there to offer them a mea culpa. He said, we made mistakes here. Our engagement with you wasn't what it should have been. Blamed that on the FT, so it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was a full, I'm going to take full responsibility, because his explanation was what happened was after the Financial Times published that story, it meant the starting gun was fired before number 10 were ready, and that's why things ended as they did. But I think there is clearly an acknowledgement that the various things they're trying to get from this ruse have not gone as planned.
Right, so James, if Oliver Lewis, or Sonic as we called him when he worked here, is now going off to admit that the government's made a mistake, do you think this means there is a bigger apology coming down the road? Might even the Prime Minister admit that he basically got it wrong?
So the most interesting thing I've learned today is that this internal market bill does not go to the House of Lords until after the EU Council in the middle of next month. That is hugely significant for two reasons. First, it means that the UK will not have committed a specific and limited breach of international law by the time of that summit.
Mm.
That matters. Secondly...
Wait, why does that matter so much? If we passed a bill saying you're going to break the law, you're still in as much trouble, are you not?
No. Because the bill won't be on the statute book. It won't be passed. It will still be in the legislative process.
Right, but it doesn't make much... I mean, you're still committed to it. You're still...
It makes a big difference because in the EU, there is a debate about how to handle the UK's behaviour. And I think the fact the bill is not on the statute book, the bill is not the law, matters. Now, the second thing of that is, as KB was pointing out to me earlier, Boris Johnson talked today at the liaison committee about how, you know, these clauses had to stay on the table until things have been resolved. There's also this question of how the bill gets through the House of Lords. It is possible that you can see a kind of dramatic moment where something is offered up by the EU at the European Council, and Boris Johnson says, following the statement from the European Council, I'm quite happy to retire these clauses because they're not necessary, because the EU is negotiating in good faith and has said that the UK will be listed as a third country for SPS products, but the Joint Committee will accelerate work on the risk of a set of at-risk goods and all of those things. So I think in terms of the choreography of the negotiations, this is important because it crafts a way that these clauses could never reach the statute book because the issue, Boris Johnson could declare that the issue had been resolved.
But so, Katie, do you think this was Boris Johnson's plan all along then, to come up with something outrageous, to have everybody make a big fuss about it, and its pure existence is justified by the fact that it's something which he will take off the table once he gets a concession from the EU? So the whole, maybe this whole drama, rather than going against the government's wishes, is actually going exactly as they planned, because you've now got a fuss over something which the government will be willing to trade for something else from Europe.
So I don't think it's gone exactly as they planned for some of the reasons we mentioned earlier, and I think some of the level of backlash has actually served to undermine their intention. But I think the general aim, which appears to, I think one interpretation which I probably lean towards, which is to say, look, if we want to have a deal, if you don't, we are doing some tidying up on our end, / breaking international law, so that we can then do what we want if it's a no-deal scenario. I think the aim was to say, give us a deal. If not, we're going to do something which you don't expect. Mm. And I think that, broadly speaking, you've kind of got there. I think it's been a bit clunkier. And I think that it has shown, despite the majority of 80, Boris Johnson doesn't, you know, have... Although people talk about the yes men, you know, it isn't just yes men. They've had to do some work on it. But I think generally speaking, that message has landed to a degree. But we've also heard from Brussels today, Ursula von der Leyen, saying, you know, every day Brexit deal becomes less likely, every day that passes. Now, clearly some of this is posturing, but I think it is still the case where it feels very murky as to where we actually are, depending on who you speak to.
And James, what would you say the chances of a Brexit deal are right now?
My slightly Panglossian view is that I actually think the chance of a deal have increased, because I think that the need for the UK needs a deal. We've heard today about the UK floating something on fishing that the EU likes. I also think if you look at the struggle with COVID that both the UK has and several other countries in Europe have, I wonder whether there's a kind of sense that this is not really now the moment to add more trouble, confusion, disruption.
You mean the COVID panic makes everybody less likely to brave a no-deal
solution? I think it limits bandwidth, which is bad for getting a deal. But I think it also makes everyone think, wouldn't it be better to have these fights in the future rather than now? You know, there's enough disruption to deal with right now. And the third thing, which I still think, which is the thing that still makes me the most optimistic, is the UK and the EU remain on geopolitics very aligned. Right, you know, whether it comes to the Iran, how to handle Iran, how to handle climate change, the UK and the EU's foreign policy positions remain very similar. And I just wonder whether we've always known that desire not to disrupt that geopolitical cooperation at a moment of fragility for the West ultimately creates the desire and the will to get a deal. My biggest worry is this, is last time round, the deal, we all thought we were heading for a no deal. And then there was that Boris Leo Varadkar walk in the woods in that Cheshire hotel where weddings are held. I suspect it'd be glad of the business at the moment. But what worries me is there isn't a Leo Varadkar figure to go for that walk with, because they're all 27 EU countries are involved in this negotiation. Well, last time round, it was really the EU was happy if Ireland was happy. And the second thing that worries me is that COVID is swallowing bandwidth, so that there isn't a chance for two people to go, for Boris Johnson and another figure to go for that walk and to actually say, you know, look, we both want a deal. Let's try and work out how to, let's get out of our trenches and try and work out how we can get that. But I might be being too Panglossian, but I do wonder whether. I do wonder whether the chance of a deal are not on a dramatic, but on a slight uptick.
So what percent?
I always feel that this percent game is
a fun game, though, James.
No, but I'll tell you why I think it's not a fun game. Because
everyone says, it puts you on the spot?
Everyone says, no, because everyone says 40%, which basically covers your CYA for all eventualities.
Wait, is that your answer, then?
No, you're
Panglossian, so are we thinking, what, 60?
No, I mean, I'm not, but
I'll go for 70, right? I'll go for 70. What about you?
I'm nowhere near as high as that.
KB?
I think I'll go 40.
And James, you're neutral, aren't you?
No, I think it is on an upswing.
And from what to what?
In a kind of 45 to 55 range.
Okay, that's great, fine. So let's go for a 50 mean. You heard it here first. And we'll hold you to that, James, as the negotiations
I think it's
keep
very
going.
Hard to hold me to 50% prediction.
Well, you've got half chance of being right or wrong. James and Katie, thanks very much indeed. Thanks for joining us. And also do tune in to Spectator TV. We've got our third episode at 6 o'clock tomorrow night, hosted by Andrew Neil. And we've just heard that our main guest is going to be Anders Tegnell, Sweden's state epidemiologist and author of its controversial COVID strategy. So join us on Spectator TV tomorrow night at 6, or catch up on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu.